From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It was a wild week last week for the Trump administration. Today, the president is tweeting that the White House is not in chaos. But turmoil has been a pretty regular mode. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, historian Tom Ricks has been watching. He's been writing about Winston Churchill and George Orwell, thinking about core principles of liberal democracy and Donald Trump. This hour on Point, Tom Ricks on Churchill, Orwell, and Trump. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see unfolding in the leadership of Donald Trump? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Thomas Ricks joins me in just a moment. But first, for the latest from the White House, we turn to Julie Bykowitz in Washington. She's White House reporter for the Associated Press. Julie, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
General John Kelly sworn in as chief of staff today. What changes are anticipated with the advent of his coming to the role so recently vacated by Reince Priebus?
Well, one thing that we can tell so far is that the president has a great deal of respect for retired Marine General John Kelly, who replaced Reince Priebus in a move that was both expected and sudden all at the same time late last week. The president has had nothing but positive sort of superlatives to say about Kelly, calling him a superstar and spectacular. And the thinking here is that perhaps Kelly will be able, through, you know, commanding that sort of respect from the president, will actually be able to convert it into some order and discipline within the White House. That's something that Reince Priebus wasn't able to do in his short but very eventful 6 months as chief of staff.
The president tweeting this morning, no White House chaos, but order and discipline seemed in short supply last week. Remind us of what was going on last week that left many people, including many fellow Republicans, shaking their heads.
Well, sure. Just, you know, so many things happened both on a policy level and then also on the staffing front. You know, taking a look specifically at the staffing, the dominoes started falling about a week and a couple of days ago when Anthony Scaramucci, who is a friend of Trump's, was hired into the White House, unbeknownst to Sean Spicer, the press secretary at the time, and over the objections of Reince Priebus and some other members of the senior staff there at the White House. It really showed that Trump wanted to make a significant change and very quickly in his senior leadership team. And Scaramucci's hiring immediately inspired Sean Spicer to resign, and then sort of all week there was this very nasty and open, unusually open, back and forth between Reince Priebus and Scaramucci, the new communications director, that all sort of ultimately led to the departure of Priebus on Friday. So those were sort of the top-level changes. Now, as that was all happening, of course, you had the latest in the healthcare debate going on that the White House was, you know, closely paying attention to. It ended in sort of an overnight debacle with the Senate not being able to really move forward at this point on healthcare. So the White House is continuing to face an uphill battle on how to contend with healthcare. They're trying to get going on changes to tax policy. And this is all happening as we are about to enter August, which is usually a pretty sleepy month in Washington. I suspect that it may not be the case this time.
General Kelly has come from the Department of Homeland Security, which he's headed up. What about the knock-on effect of moving him out of there? Are there other changes in the cabinet or those around Trump that are now anticipated?
The only sort of immediate thing that we're all keeping an eye on here is what happens to the rest of the White House staff that was, you know, serving as sort of longtime aides to Reince Priebus, people who had followed him into the White House from the Republican National Committee that Priebus had led for years and years. And so we'll wait to see if there are other staffing level changes, you know, that happen as a result of Priebus no longer being in the White House. But of course, you've got sort of ongoing tensions with other cabinet members. Rex Tillerson, who leads state, has not been an easy fit within the administration. And then Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, has had very open and sort of raw battles with the president, who's been, you know, taken every opportunity to say that he's disappointed in him for recusing himself from the probe on Russian interference in the presidential election. So there certainly could be more coming just this month.
A tweet from the president: no WHs in White House chaos this morning. We'll see. Julie Bykowitz, White House reporter for the Associated Press, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
With us now from Bangor, Maine, is Thomas Ricks. Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, author. His latest book is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. He's covered American military doings for a long time now, written big books on the Iraq War fiasco, prominent among them, and more. This time out, he's looking at two giant thinkers and actors on the stage of the 20th century. Tom Ricks, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
What are you thinking as you watch what was last week described as turmoil, chaos, and more in this White House, about the grounding of this president in the traditions that Churchill and Orwell not only came out of, but, as you write, upheld?
A couple of broad thoughts and one specific thought. Broad thought is, I weep for my country. Trump is a mess. He is certainly, I think, the worst president in the history of this country. We've never had someone so profoundly ignorant and perhaps deranged. He's a bully. He's a weakling. He's a boaster. He is a vulgarian. He really is a disappointment and a worrisome person. The only thing, the only hope I take away from Trump is his sheer incompetence might limit the damage he does to our country and our traditions and our values. He is not a conservative. He is a reactionary. He has none of the traditional loyalties to institutions, to law, that conservatives typically have. Specific thought on John Kelly. I wrote about him in my book, The Generals. I know him not as well as I know James Mattis. I think Trump hired Kelly because he thinks Kelly can be an enforcer, you know, a disciplined Marine, a natural-born killer. But Kelly is no longer going to be acting as a Marine. He's going to be a political functionary, a political actor. And I think that's going to be a very different role for him.
What about the generals around this president, more broadly speaking? I mean, you've just laid down a pretty tough bill of critique against Donald Trump. He has a lot of generals in his inner circle. He's got Mattis. He's got McMaster. He has now John Kelly as his chief of staff. Do you see them as buffering, as enabling, as the sort of steady hands in this administration while the president goes about the presidency in his unique style?
Normally, I would be very worried by having so many generals in an administration. It is unprecedented in American history, I think, to have a chief of staff, a secretary of defense, a national security advisor, who are all Marine or all generals. In this case, I do like having adults in the room and the rest of the government. I think what we have essentially right now is a decapitated government. We don't really have a president. We have someone who plays a president on TV and on Twitter, but he's very ineffective. Not much happens. You know, the only legislation that's come out of this Congress is a piece he didn't like, the sanctions against Russia. He's been unable to move the rest of his agenda through a Republican Senate and House. So I like having sort of adults in the rest of the government, but I don't want to see people at the White House enabling Trump. My attitude towards Trump is, if we're going to have like the Corleone family running America, I'd rather have Fredo than Michael. And right now we have Fredo.
A lot of people have been thinking about our Constitution and how its checks and balances and mechanisms rein in all of the branches of government, the presidency included. Do you see the Constitution, with this bleak view of the president that you've laid out right off the bat, do you see the Constitution as steadying the boat here as the country moves ahead? Is it doing it already?
I do very much. In fact, if I were to print up a bumper sticker, it would be, "Have you hugged a federal judge today?" I think the judiciary has been a shock to Trump. I don't think he understands how it's supposed to work. And they have provided a clear check. And a check is, like in hockey, a strong action. And he is being checked routinely by the federal courts. And the other branch of government, legislative, is working through in a negative fashion by not passing his agenda, despite ostensibly being in the same political party as him, the majorities in Congress. I like the Constitution because it gives us an operating manual for how this country is supposed to run. It actually prescribes behavior. If a political candidate hits a reporter, that's un-American. How do we know that? Because the First Amendment provides for freedom of the press. Likewise, if a university refuses to allow someone to speak and shouts them down, that's un-American behavior, again, because of the First Amendment, allowing for freedom of expression and association. So I actually do think the Founding Fathers had a lot of wisdom in the Constitution, and they wrote it partly in anticipation of someone like Trump. Remember, they were reacting to King George III, himself a madman. And they were reacting to how the British government had treated the Americans in the years before the American Revolution. So they limited power. And by the way, speaking of generals, they also limited military power, making the military subordinate to civilian authority.
Trump describes or likes to portray the military as in his corner, in his camp. He's done it at graduation ceremonies recently. You're in deep touch with that sector. Just got a couple seconds before the break, but are they? Is it?
Yes, but I think with their fingers crossed.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Asprey. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about leadership and turmoil in the time of Donald Trump with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, historian Tom Ricks. His latest book is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Will a general, John Kelly, as chief of staff, change this president's ways? And Churchill and Orwell insisted on objective facts as their baseline for taking on the world. Does Mr. Trump? Tom Ricks, looking back at the history of these two men who were so influential in the 20th century, he's written a lot about American military and military operations in the 21st century, Iraq War. His book was Fiasco, big book there. This morning, General John Kelly, out of the Marines, sworn in as chief of staff to the president. Over the weekend, former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, said to still be a confidant of the president, was on NBC's Meet the Press talking about the shakeup of the White House. Here was his advice for the incoming chief of staff, General John Kelly.
The thing that General Kelly should do is not try to change Donald Trump. Chuck, as you know, I've said you have to let Trump be Trump. That is what has made him successful over the last 30 years. That is what the American people voted for. And anybody who thinks they're going to change Donald Trump doesn't know Donald Trump.
Tom Ricks, I don't want to leave what's going on currently for long here. But take us back to your guys, Churchill and Orwell, and what they fought for, what they argued for in their very prominent careers that's important to remember now at this moment in 2017?
I'd say that the 1930s were a political time like ours now, a time of political turbulence, a time of polarization, and a time that especially people began privileging opinion over fact. So, for example, on the left, the view was communism is good. So anything that helps communism is good. So lying is good if it helps communism. And to this, George Orwell disagreed vigorously. He was a socialist, mm-hmm. but he was not a Stalinist. And in Spain, when he saw the left lying as much as the right, he was extremely upset and thought deeply about it. And I think the roots of his books, 1984 and Animal Farm, both come out of his experience in Spain. He actually wrote a fascinating thing about fake news that I can read to you if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Coming out of Spain. Hold on one second. I need to put my glasses on.
Okay.
So this is from his book, Homage to Catalonia.
Mm-hmm.
He's come back from Spain. He goes there as a fan of the left. He is shot through the throat while fighting the nationalists, the fascists, the right-wingers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is chased through the streets of Barcelona by the Republican government police, whom he ostensibly has been fighting on the side of.
The left.
Mm-hmm. He comes back disappointed and puzzled. And he reads all the newspapers in England about the Spanish Civil War, and he's stunned, and this is what he writes. In Spain, for the first time, I saw newspaper reports which did not bear any relation to the facts. I saw great battles reported where there had been no fighting, in complete silence where hundreds of men had been killed. I saw troops who had fought bravely denounced as cowards and traitors, and others who had never seen a shot fired hailed as the heroes of imaginary victories. And I saw newspapers in London retailing those lies and eager intellectuals building superstructures over events that never happened. And I think that actually speaks to today. We have a lot of people ranting on about things that never happened. The notion that Donald Trump at this point is a successful president is absurd.
What about Churchill? What he fought for and what light it casts on where we are right now.
This is one thing I love about Churchill and Orwell. Orwell's a leftist. Churchill's a conservative, a genuine conservative, and an imperialist. Yet they both adhere to facts. They insist on standing on the facts. Churchill spent most of the 1930s in the political wilderness. He was an outsider in his own party. He was mocked. They said he was a washed-up old man, and the reason was he objected to Nazi Germany, and he said Germany is rearming and we must deal with it. This was unwelcome news to his own conservative party and especially to the conservative prime ministers Baldwin and then Chamberlain. And he stood on the floor of the House of Commons starting in 1933
mm-hmm.
and said the fact of the matter is that the Nazis are rebuilding and rearming. Nobody wanted to hear this, and they would not allow him to participate in the government. They kept him out of the British cabinet until finally, in May 1940, after World War II has begun for England, he is called to become prime minister.
Donald Trump famously put Winston Churchill's bust into the Oval Office, back into the Oval Office. Compare and contrast these two. I mean, Churchill, for those with a broad reading of history, has a reputation as a hothead among some, a big talker. Donald Trump clearly sees some kind of kinship or would like to with Winston Churchill. Compare them, Tom.
I think the biggest difference is that Churchill was a deeply read man in history. He understood history. He was fascinated. He understood government and was fascinated by it. In fact, I was thinking about this movie Dunkirk and mm-hmm. how well Churchill was positioned as prime minister. He'd only been in office about 3 weeks when the Dunkirk evacuation happens and hundreds of thousands of British and French troops are pulled off the beaches of Belgium and France mm-hmm. and brought back to England. Churchill was steeped in all these. He had been in the British Army. He had fought in what is now Pakistan, in South Africa, mm-hmm. in Sudan, and in World War I. He had been head of the British Navy, head of the Admiralty in World War I as well. He also had a pilot's license. He knew how to fly aircraft and actually would, during World War II, occasionally take the controls of aircraft he was traveling in. So here's a guy who has experience in the ground force, the naval force, and the air force. he has studied history intensely. He's written volumes of history. He wrote in his lifetime 15 million words. Mm. By my calculation, that's the equivalent of over 1,000 books. Mm. So there couldn't be a greater contrast to Donald Trump in his understanding of government, of militaries, and of history.
What about temperamentally?
Temperamentally, there is a bit of a similarity in that I think Trump lacks empathy, and I think Churchill lacked empathy. One thing you see in World War II is he can be rather brutal in getting rid of people. He doesn't pay a lot of attention to people's feelings. Some people around him said the only feelings he ever really paid attention to were his own. That said, I think that kind of proved to be a strength for Churchill in World War II. Someone of more empathy might not have made it through that war. He was prime minister from 1939 to 1945, 6 long years of war.
These last 6 months, going on 7 now, have seemed long sometimes. It's felt, the president's tweet this morning notwithstanding, it's felt like tumult very, very often. I think right across the political spectrum, people have shared that feeling. I wonder sometimes, Tom, I mean, this has been a period really without crisis. We haven't had war. We haven't had a major conflict. We haven't had any major incident. And still, it's felt so tumultuous day to day. We could have crisis, an actual crisis. What do you anticipate from the combination of this president, those around him, the generals around him, if it actually comes to something that's a real crisis and not kind of a media uproar?
That's a very good point. By the way, the tumultuous last 6 months have made me so glad I'm not a reporter in Washington anymore. Mm. You might feel the same way. Mm. I just feel so sorry for these reporters who can't get a break. I mean, you go home and the desk is going to call you and say, oh, the president's tweeting again. You know, it's like this never-ending tantrum on Twitter. The president's tormenting his attorney general again. This is just unexplored territory.
But compare that to the tumult of Winston Churchill. He had to deal with reports of victories and losses in war. We feel in a state of tumult, and it's about Twitter's tweets.
Well, that's the second point is, yes, as you say, we have not had a major crisis yet. And I'm not sure what would happen. I think this White House likely would shatter under the pressure. The good thing is, Trump is so disconnected from the rest of the government that the rest of the federal government, I think, is just sort of chunking along. James Mattis is running the Defense Department and doing, I think, a very good job of it. Tillerson doesn't seem happy at State. I think he likely will leave. But the rest of the government is actually pretty robust, even though we have this sinkhole of incompetence at the center of the government in the White House. When I think of Churchill and Orwell and how they would look at this today, though, I go back to the two-step method that both of them arrived at independently. And that was, have your principles, know what you stand for, and second, determine what the facts are, and then apply your principles to the facts. So, for example, if somebody in this country undermines free speech, I would say, well, my principle is that's a bad thing, and so we need to react to that and figure out what the facts of the case are. Likewise, this also made them willing to criticize their own sides, and I think that's a crucial point, is when they saw their own sides, the facts indicated that someone on their own side was undermining a cherished principle, they criticized them. This is not a way to make friends, but it is a way to find your way through tumultuous political times.
What would you say about the Republican Party then in that role under the presidency of this Republican, titular Republican, Donald Trump?
I have been surprised at how quiet, even cowardly, the Republican majority has been in Congress. They occasionally stand up and say, you know, you shouldn't treat people that way, but they don't really act on it very much. The people who I do find I'm paying a lot of attention to are anti-Trump conservatives. And I'm thinking here of people like Elliot Cohen, who was a good piece on the Atlantic Monthly's website today, Michael Gerson, Jennifer Rubin, Charles Krauthammer. A lot of conservatives have been speaking up and saying, you know, Trump is not acting like a conservative. He seems ignorant and contemptuous of the Constitution. He clearly is not someone with family values of the type American conservatives have talked about for decades. We have these White House officials talking like second-rate mafiosi, like Scaramucci has recently. And these conservatives have a pretty powerful critique of Trump and the people around him that I find illuminating because I'm not a conservative and I don't hold those conservative principles in the way that these people do. So those are the people I'm paying a lot of attention to right now. What I'm looking for and haven't yet seen, and if your callers have any, I'd be interested, people on the left who are intelligently critiquing the Democratic Party and saying, we can do better and this is how. I've been surprised at how quiet the Democrats have been. In fact, I've come to think that the biggest single problem, political problem in this country is not Donald Trump. It is the Democratic Party, which seems unable to stand up on its 2 feet and come back and say, here's what is wrong with President Trump. Here's what we would do instead.
Tom Ricks is with us. His new book is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Joins us from Bangor, Maine. Tom, callers for you. Wes in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Wes, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Tom Ricks.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My concern is quite simple. I'm looking at a man who has no combat experience. In fact, the only experience he has is 5 draft deferments during the time I went to war. I'm also looking at the fact that he is probably going to take a page from the George Bush playbook and put us into a war, knowing that we don't eliminate presidents when we're at war, no matter how bad they are.
Tom Ricks?
The only possible solution.
Yeah. Oh, I missed the possible solution. Are you there, Wes? What have you got?
The solution, obviously, is the Republican Party is going to have to stand up and impeach him. We got to get him out of office.
Tom Ricks, speak to the impulse or the grab for war as a solution to a White House under siege. We've got North Korea with more reports of its missile testing now, claiming that they can hit anywhere in the continental U.S. now. Do you see this as something that this president might turn to? Would the Pentagon be ready and willing? Is there a break there?
I think that no matter who the president is or will be, there is a significant chance of a U.S. war in North Korea in the next couple of years. Right now, they do not present a threat to the United States. These rockets, it's one thing to fire a rocket off. It's another thing to fire a rocket that can carry a warhead and a warhead that can go off. But they are trying to go in that direction. I don't think the United States or the rest of the world will allow that. So I do think, you know, there's a growing chance of war with North Korea. It would be a terrible thing if people thought Trump went to war to somehow bolster his own presidency. On the second thing, Republicans impeaching Trump, I thought until recently that that was impossible, that that wouldn't happen, they wouldn't go along with it. But I think one thing you saw was the U.S. Senate has a very strong sense of self-respect. And for the Senate as an institution and for individual senators, current and former. And I think senators were more shocked than anyone else in the country by the president's treatment of Jeff Sessions, his attorney general. That is not the way they think U.S. senators should be treated. And I think the willingness to slam dunk Trump on health care, on Trump care, came partly out of their unhappiness with the way that Trump has treated Sessions.
Of course, that was a willingness by one vote. I mean, there were an awful lot of senators who lined up for that bill.
Yeah, because they knew that the other senators would bail them out by voting it down.
I don't. Do you think everybody knew exactly what John McCain was going to do in that last minute? I don't know.
I think somehow the game was rigged. Yeah.
Yeah. If it should come to war with North Korea, you said the government is chugging along. But doesn't the Oval Office matter in time of war? I mean, can the Pentagon really just run with the ball? Given what you've said about Donald Trump, pretty stern criticism. One wonders what that would look like, put war together with the the presidency that you've described. Hold that question in mind, Tom, if you'd be good enough, while we go to a short break here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with Thomas Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's out with a new history and something more, a book called Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom, about these two towering figures of the 20th century. What it was that they fought for, objective facts, for starters, as the base of their views on how the world ought to be proceeding. George Orwell and Winston Churchill, wartime Prime Minister, of course, of the United Kingdom. Tom joins us from Bangor, Maine today, author of Fiasco, author of The Gamble, The Generals, lots of books on the U.S. military. He writes a blog now for Foreign Policy Magazine and former Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. You can join us this hour. Churchill and Orwell insisted on objective facts, Tom Ricks reminds us, as their baseline for taking on the world. Does Mr. Trump, and what happens if this White House meets a real crisis in the world? What then? Debbie in Manchester, Tennessee is calling. Debbie, you're on with Tom Ricks. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And wanted to ask Mr. Ricks, may have misunderstood, but I thought he was blaming Democrats for Trump and not opposing him enough. Just would like more clarification on how he came to that conclusion. I'm just seeing a major resistance from Democrats United. I mean, every one of them voted against every repeal bill of the Obamacare legislation. And I just, and then when I hear some left, more left-leaning people, like left-wing, say that they don't want Democrats saying Trump is what we need to oppose without any of their own ideas, but they do have their own ideas. You're just not hearing about them. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you, Debbie. Tom, can you expand on what you mean with your flag on the Democrats there?
I think it all goes to campaign finance. You can't run a political party these days without getting a ton of money from corporations and from Wall Street. That's not a bad thing for the Republicans. Those are natural allies of the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party is also beholden to corporations and Wall Street firms for campaign donations. And that's not a good thing. I think that has confused the Democrats about who they are and who they represent. I don't think Hillary Clinton spoke well to middle America. She seemed much more comfortable with Wall Street than with Main Street. And so I think we're in a situation now where the Democratic Party didn't present enough of a difference on how it really talks and thinks about the country from the Republican Party. It's worrisome to me, because what we saw in the last election was, no matter whether Trump won or Hillary Clinton won, Goldman Sachs won. And I'm not a big fan of Bernie Sanders, but I do agree with something he said, which is that nowadays Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress. And until the Democrats learn to talk about that, I don't think they're going to resonate enough with people. It also surprises me that here we have had the Democrats lose the presidency to one of the oddest, most vulnerable candidates we've ever seen, yet there's no change in Democratic leadership, in Chuck Schumer as Senate Minority Leader and Nancy Pelosi leading the Democrats in the House. I think we need a new generation of Democrats coming up who speak differently and especially are not so beholden to campaign finance.
There's an answer for you, Debbie, and I appreciate your call. Jan in Winthrop, Maine. Jan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you so much. First of all, I thank Thomas Hicks for laying out what I think is so far the best analysis of Donald Trump that I have heard. Anywhere.
Well, living in Maine helps,
here.
I think.
I have to confess, I live in the Hudson Valley. I get here as much as I can. But, Mr. Hicks, I have to know if you are familiar with a book by Yale history professor Thomas Snyder. It's called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th century.
We've got Tom Ricks, Jan, and I think it's Timothy Snyder, but yes, On Tyranny, the book is out. What does it have you thinking, Jan?
I'm confused, all these wonderful Toms today. Timothy Snyder, he does spell out how Trump is so clearly following the playbook of an aspiring dictator. And 20 things we all need to do. And as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, I do agree that the Democrats did not present a strong enough alternative. But the real problem is money, and Citizens Union. And how are we going to combat this aspiring dictator? Is my problem with voter suppression and money going mostly to a large part to the other side.
Jen, let us pick it up. Timothy Snyder is out with his book, yes, On Tyranny. He looks back at Europe in the 20th century and how democracy there fell to tyranny, Nazism, fascism. Is the United States less vulnerable, Tom?
I haven't read the book, but I read some of the articles from Professor Snyder that became the book. I do think that there are autocratic impulses in this country and especially in this president. Trump seems very comfortable with a lot of the trappings of an autocrat. When you call the media as a whole the enemy of the people, that's a terrible thing in this country. When you are constantly attacking people in the most vicious and actually childlike ways, you degrade political discourse. This country is built on vigorous adversarial systems. The founding fathers in their wisdom designed that. We are supposed to have power banging against each other. But it also is supposed to lead to compromise. And Trump seems to utterly lack any sense a political compromise. To take it back to John Kelly, mm-hmm. one thing people haven't noticed about John Kelly is that he served in the Marine Corps for a couple of terms as the legislative liaison for the Marines to the U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
He has worked on Capitol Hill. And anybody who has understands that the members of Congress don't work for the president. They are independent power centers. You don't give them orders. You supplicate them. You ask them to help out. Ultimately, it has to be about compromise. And I don't think Trump has a shred of understanding about that. Maybe Kelly can help him with it. I don't think so. I don't think at this point that Donald Trump, an angry, ignorant old man, is going to be able to learn very much.
Ken in Huntland, Tennessee. Ken, you're on with Tom Ricks. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I am a conservative and therefore sort of stuck with the Republican Party in a way. I did not vote for Donald Trump in the selection process for our candidate, but mm-hmm. I felt like I had to vote for him because I thought, he had to be better than Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I'm desperate for the people in our legislature to stand up. As your guest was just speaking about the tyranny possibility, and the Republican Party is going to have to just buck the trend to constantly band together, which both parties have been doing, it seems like, now for two generations. You know, we can't cooperate with the other side. We just can't, because if we do, we lose power. The legislative branch, as he was just pointing out, is autonomous. They have the beholding to the president, and the presidents have been fighting. We've been fighting over the possible tyranny of presidents since George Washington. George Washington saw the possibilities of it and mm-hmm. worked hard to try to belay that. And we've had a few presidents along the way, some of them good guys and some of them bad guys. Jackson, a bad guy, FDR, a pretty good guy, but still tried to tyrannize the presidency.
What needs to happen now, Ken, in your view?
I think the legislative branches need to show Trump, Republicans and Democrats, that he's only 33% of the solution here. And they're one of the 33%, and the legislature, the judicial branch is another. And the Republicans are just going to have to cinch up their suspenders and say, you know what? Yes, he was elected on the Republican ticket, but the man has no sense of the propriety or the logic behind cooperation or you know, of anything else that it takes to be a decent president. And they're going to have to force him in his lane, or they're going to have to get rid of him, as dramatic as that sounds.
Ken, I appreciate your call. Tom, we've heard your thoughts on the Democrats. What about the Republican Party at this point? We've got you on the Senate, but it's more than that. They've got this president. We haven't seen a lot of breaking ranks here. Do you think they will? Do you think they can?
I think actually we saw the president break ranks with the Republican Party when he fired his old chief of staff on Friday and brought in someone else. I think he's walking away from the party. Notice that over the weekend, among his other tweets, he denounced Senate Republicans as looking like a bunch of people foolishly wasting their time.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the way you talk to your own party in public or even in private. So I think you may see Republicans reacting and breaking away from the president. One thing I would say to conservatives like Ken generally also is I think there's a growing sense that Trump is trying to trample on the Constitution, and once that begins, no one knows where it ends. So, for example, in his attacks on the First Amendment, I think there's a sense that everything that happens to the First Amendment now might happen to the Second Amendment down the road, and you want to be really careful opening the can of worms of attacking and trying to undo the Constitution.
Jim in Ludlow, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well.
My comment, number one, I just finished Tom Ricks' book, and it was outstanding. I wish, as a former teacher in the public schools, I wish that it can become required reading for teaching young students history and, more importantly, the importance of critical thinking. Before break, a little while ago, you said, well, what would George Orwell do? What would his voice do mm-hmm. in these political times? And I think what's clear to me from reading Tom Ricks' book is that his voice expressed itself in Animal Farm in 1984. What he would see and what he would be warning about is when power, absolute power, looks to consolidate itself, one of the first beachheads they look to establish is to assault fact. And that came through so impressively in this book. And that is what we are in the midst of. And going forward, the only way I see that battle being taken up is with educating young people and having them actually read books like 1984 and then companion pieces like this. I would highly recommend this book to anyone.
Jim, I really appreciate your call. Tom, if I may, our time grows short. What would you cite? What would you cite here on the air, Tom, from Orwell to speak to this moment? A message from Orwell, and for that matter, Churchill as well.
Well, Jim, first, thanks for reading the book. I really appreciate it. You sound like my ideal reader, and also thanks for being a teacher. I think they're not appreciated enough in this country. This is why at the end of my book, I talk about Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from the Birmingham jail. He does what Orwell did. He says, what are the facts of the matter, and how do we act on them? He says, here are the facts, here are my principles, here's how we act. And he reacts and he says, look, don't treat me and the KKK as just two sides and everybody needs to simmer down. One side is right here, one side is wrong, and I am asking the U.S. government to enforce the law.
There's the voice of Martin Luther King. What about Orwell himself? What about Churchill? How would they speak to this moment?
They would insist that personal liberty, that liberty begins with the individual. This is the core of 1984 when, at one point, the hero of 1984, by the way, named Winston, says, if you can say that two fingers held up are two and four fingers held up are four, everything else flows from that. Liberty flows from that. You insist on the right of the individual to perceive the truth. That you say, no, the government is not in charge of truth, nor is Fox News in charge of truth, nor, for that matter, is NPR. That the individual has the right to perceive what the facts are and then to act on them. And I think Churchill would agree. Orwell says that is the beginning of personal liberty. And I think that's kind of where we should be. Don't let opinion, don't let shouting on the TV run the political agenda. Insist on facts and decent political discourse.
And Churchill, if he could whisper in the ear of Donald Trump right now?
He'd say, step down.
Step down. I don't think that was his style. That wasn't Churchill's style.
No, but Churchill was never give up if on a matter of principle. Never give up. But Churchill also was a savvy politician, and he would look at Trump and say, you are a loser playing a losing hand. This is not going to get better. For the good of your country, man, step down. And that's kind of what he was saying in the 1930s to the conservatives of his own party who were leading Britain down this hazardous path of appeasing the Nazis.
Thomas Ricks. His new book is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Tom, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. On Point is produced by Michael DeSocio, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Camila Kerwin, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Allison Poley, and James Ross. With help from Yumi Araki, Alvin Buzinka, and Evie Monti, and Gretchen Voss. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.